Cass Sunstein, I'm fascinated by the Kudza-like growth of behavioral economics. It's everywhere now. How did it come to you?
I taught for many years at the University of Chicago, which is the home of old-style economics, the kind of economics that got some Nobel Prizes for University of Chicago faculty members and had a great influence on our government and also, I think, on our culture. So University of Chicago, it's often called neoclassical economics. Milton Friedman is a big practitioner. Ronald Reagan was greatly influenced by it. Some of our celebration of free markets is affected by the notion that people are rational. So old-style economics, that is the dominant way of doing economics in the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, said people are really terrific at figuring out how to satisfy their own goals. So the idea is when people buy food, when they vote for candidates, when they think about religion, when they buy houses and enter the mortgage market, when they decide whether to diet or not, when they decide who to date, they are rational. That's old-style economics, and it still has a huge influence. The behavioral types, and this is really, I think, the most exciting intellectual movement in the last 30 years, say, well, it's not exactly the true that people are irrational. We're not random, but we don't really follow the textbook idea of human rationality. We have a little Homer Simpson in us, and that means that we are sometimes impulsive. We sometimes follow the short-term interest rather than the long-term interest. We sometimes get confused when we're figuring out what mortgage to select or what credit card plan to buy. To get into. We don't do that well with rental car companies sometimes. We don't deal with risks very well. So before 9/11, a lot of Americans and the American government was probably too complacent about the risks of a terrorist attack. After 9/11, we were probably too frightened. So this kind of careening between complacency and fear, which you sometimes observe in the domain of maybe climate change as well as terrorism, the behavioral people think they can explain that. So the goal is to do economics with real people rather than to do economics with caricatures of rational man.
This conversation, ours, is a continuation of conversations we've had with people like George Lakoff, who worries about your mind on politics, and Dan Ariely, who wrote a wonderful bestseller on predictably irrational, and all the hidden traps, self-deception, passions, prejudices that get in the way of this stuff. But they're all deriving the fundamental notions from cognitive science. You know, the neurons that wire together and fire together, this kind of thing. Would you just track the passage of these ideas from the brain sciences to the schools of law and economics and politics to policy, where you try to drive it in your book, Nudge, but then also to politics itself. We've got to talk about how these notions play out in the 08 campaign in the United States.
I don't think the movement was from cognitive science. I think cognitive science is actually a latecomer to this, that it originally started with some psychology that didn't involve cognitive science. Two Israelis, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, did a bunch of amazing experiments in the 1970s where they said people use some mental shortcuts in trying to think about risk. If a recent event, for example, is in your head, say it involves a crime or a misfortune or something wonderful happening, then you will think it's really probable that the crime or the misfortune or the wonderful thing will happen. They said when people are thinking about economic values, they often anchor, is their term, on some number, which is the first one that comes into their head. So they talk about recent events having undue importance, can make us too too confident or too fearful, that when we're thinking about economic values, sometimes these anchors turn out to be really important. This was work in psychology. It didn't have to do with brains in the sense of how the internal operation of the brain works. This way of thinking from psychology migrated first into economics. So there has really been a revolution in economic thinking because economists are trying to do their work with a realistic rather than artificial sense of what human beings are like. So the idea is we can do economics with Homer Simpson as our types rather than doing economics with computers as our types. People just aren't computers.
What's the Homer Simpson example that we should be thinking of?
Well, when Homer in one episode went to buy a gun, the gun owner told him there's a 3-day waiting period, and Homer responded, "What? 3 days? I'm angry now." So that captures people's passion and focus on the short term. And it also captures, by the way, how law and policy can help a little. So what happened was the psychologist started to develop some ideas about how human beings use these shortcuts. Sometimes we're too optimistic. 90% of people think that they're safer than the average driver and less likely to be involved in an accident. 94% of college teachers, I say with some embarrassment, think that they are above average as college teachers. Can't be the case that 94% are better than average. So these departures made their way into economics in basically the 1990s. From that point, they made their way into the law schools and political science departments. So in the last decade, we've seen a genuine revolution where people are starting to think about how to do law and policy with a realistic sense of what human beings are like. And this is having a big impact on how we think about environmental policy, how we think about economic policy. So to give one example, Senator Obama is well aware that inertia is a very powerful human force. So Americans aren't saving enough for retirement, partly because they have to fill out the darn form in order to get into a 401k plan. So even though it's a really good idea to be involved in a 401k plan, a lot of American workers just aren't. So the behavioral economist idea is make it automatic. Make it so that if you're enrolled in the workforce, if you're starting in the workforce, you're automatically in a 401k plan. A certain percentage of your pay is going to go to savings. If you don't like it, you can opt out. That's freedom. But the behavioral point is just switch it so that it's automatic for you, like automatic payment of debts or automatic renewal of magazines. Automaticness is very effective for people. And Obama likes this idea. We behavioral types like this idea. For the mortgage crisis, we think that a serious problem people faced is that to figure out what all these terms mean in a way that makes it possible for us to assess risks takes some work, and it's much too complicated. So we think there should be a policy, which we call simplified transparency, that is, we behavioral types, where the Homer Simpsons among us, that is to say most of us who are not able to figure out a lot of numbers on the fly, can just see, oh, these are the risks we face. So what we're seeing all over the world, really, not just in the United States, is an effort to match our policies to a realistic understanding of what human limits are. Now, you mentioned cognitive science, and that really is important. But as I say, it's a latecomer. The study of how brains work and how this bears on some of the most exciting findings about how people assess risks, that's really recent stuff. That's in the last 10 years. And I think that's more speculative. It is also exciting, but it's more speculative and tentative, that is the neuroscience to date, than some of the findings we get from the economists and the psychologists. You don't have to peer into people's heads to know that if a recent event has occurred, people are going to exaggerate the probability often. And if a recent event hasn't occurred, they're going to underestimate the probability. That pretty robust finding about people doesn't depend on thinking about the amygdala which is a part of the brain that gets charged up when people are scared.
That's interesting. Would you say the cognitive sciences are the trailing edge of this movement? That's news to me.
Yeah, well, as I say, that Kahneman and Tversky got behavioral economics started in the 1970s. They didn't study brain function. They didn't look peer and decide. They didn't do brain imaging. They didn't study people's heads. They studied what people do when presented with certain questions and problems. Then the economists, Richard Thaler, most prominent among them, he'll get the Nobel Prize, started asking about how consumers behave. What do consumers care about? Does it matter if something is described as a credit card discount or as a cash surcharge? Does that matter to our behavior? How do people react when prices go up? How upset are they? Turns out, really a lot, much more than standard economic models predict. And the fact that people hate it when prices go up, they hate it when their wages are cut, that helps explain some puzzles, such as during a recession, people are fired, but their wages aren't cut. And there's a behavioral explanation for that, which is when people's wages are cut, they start to shirk. And employers know that. So wages don't fall during a recession. People are laid off, but their wages don't fall. And there's a behavioral explanation for that. Okay, that pretty imaginative economic work about how consumers behave, about how employers and workers relate, that doesn't have anything to do with cognitive science in the sense of really understanding brain function. Then the law and policy stuff started going in the late 1990s. That's really flowering now, where people started thinking, in environmental policy or risk regulation, why do we sometimes overreact and why do we sometimes underreact? And what kind of mechanisms can we put in place both in our daily lives and in our government to make sure that we're worried about the right things and not scared of the wrong things? That work doesn't depend on any neuroscience. The neuroscience that is really peering into people's brains, that is recent. There's been brain imaging stuff which is broadly supportive of some of the earlier work on people's judgments about risk, but we don't really need to go into people's brains to know that those findings are true. We just need to know how people behave and think in reaction to risk. There is some really exciting work in brain imaging and such. My own view is that we don't really need to rely on that in order to think about law and policy. We have plenty of enough to make progress.
Take it to the widest extent. Is the Enlightenment model defunct? Has behavioral economics sort of dethroned the notion that we are the species with reason, the rational ones, the self-reliant ones, too?
I think we've learned a lot about human rationality, but I wouldn't say that the Enlightenment has been dethroned. Here's a way to think of it. Some of the work in psychology and economics and in law and in policy, and here the brain imaging is very helpful, draws a distinction between two systems in the human brain. System one, as it's imaginatively called, is rapid and intuitive, sometimes impulsive. It is something human beings share with animals that aren't human. It can get us in a lot of trouble, but it does great when we're trying to flee from a predator. System one will tell you when the plane's shaking, I'm going to crash, or when you see a large dog, I should run away, he'll bite. System two, by contrast, is more deliberative and reflective and calculative. System two tells us planes are actually very safe, and large dogs are typically, not always, but typically very nice, and despite their size, they usually won't bite us. Our system one will sometimes tell us that we ought to get going on something involving, let's say, romance or safety, where system two will sometimes say, hold on a minute and think it over. We have an Enlightenment style system in the brain. That is system two. It's the prefrontal cortex. We also have something that the Enlightenment picture of humanity doesn't fit terribly well with. It includes the amygdala, which is a small part of the brain that registers fear very rapidly. So what I guess I'd say is that the Enlightenment picture of humanity isn't really threatened by behavioral economics. It's just that the behavioral picture gives us a much more complicated and satisfactory sense of what human beings are like and what kind of trouble we can get ourselves into. You can even see behavioral economics as a fabulous triumph for the Enlightenment because it provides a map or a picture of humanity by which human beings can kind of get some distance on what we're really like and try to figure out why these procrastinating, risk-taking, sometimes fearful people, that is us, what are we doing and how can we help ourselves do a little bit better?
Okay, let's come to where rubber meets road in the United States of America in 2008. How does the candidate you know very well and root for, Barack Obama, beat the public reflex, and you can feel it in late August, to revert to the automatic system, the reflexes that would vote fear or race or habit or party?
There are two things Senator Obama can do. One is to appeal to our more automatic system. And I think one reason he did so well in the Democratic primary is that people just like him. He is a genuinely terrific guy, and people respond to that. So in elections, system one, that is the more automatic reactions, has a very important role. One reason President Bush defeated Kerry and Gore is that system one in the head responds better to Bush, apparently, than to the more, less smiley, at least at that time, Gore and Kerry, less congenial seeming people than Bush at least appeared. I think Obama has some advantages on that count. You are correct, as I say, it's an important point that that Obama has some challenges too. I think his most serious challenge is that the Republican machine is trying to turn him into some sort of cartoon, which will make System 1 recoil on multiple grounds. And I think his the best way to meet that challenge is to do what he's actually always done, which is to have an adult conversation with the American people and to appeal to our reflective sides. So his inclination has been to say the country's facing some serious problems here and to talk about whether he spent too much time as a kid in Hawaii rather than the mainland or something like that really isn't very helpful, or to make false accusations about aspect of his past isn't relevant. So I expect we'll see him focusing on his actual policies, which have to do with making a serious effort to come to terms with climate change in a way that isn't economically damaging, which has to do with helping the middle class economically through the tax system in a way that actually redistributes a bit from the very wealthiest to people who are struggling, to counter the claim that he's an old-style tax-and-spend liberal. He certainly isn't that. So to meet false charges and cartoons with truth and reality.
George Lakoff makes the wonderful point that Barack Obama has a metaphorical body. Maybe all politicians do, in the sense that the body language in his case, is tall and visionary and free and supple, athletic, young, smiling. He's a gorgeous figure to look at the same time that the body language of Barack Obama since the primaries, perhaps, has been one of hesitation, of a certain kind of tensing up. The Lakoff response is that a man, especially in of his talents, has to be himself. Got to beware of bending, got to beware of hesitating, got to beware of getting locked into somebody else's format. What's the trick? How does he do it?
Well, I don't really like that kind of talk from George Lakoff, even though I think he's a distinguished person. I think it's too primitive a conception of how to think about political life. So I don't think that the election is turning on whether someone bends, and that the primary challenge facing Senator Obama is not to bend. This treats the American public a little like babies who are asking whether someone's posture is adequate. Surely this is not utterly irrelevant, but I think the Senator Obama's challenge is not to bend less, but to concretize a bit more, as he's doing, what the conception of change that he has actually is. And that once that gets going, we will have a more substantive, engaged debate than we're having in August. The greatest, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was on a wheelchair, so he was pretty bent. And even though most people didn't know he was on a wheelchair, he didn't succeed mostly because he smiled, though he did smile. He had some unbelievable policies. And so I think I wouldn't want to think of this election in terms of height and smiles and defensiveness, that contributes to some of the debasement of political life that we've suffered from over the past 20 years.
It's not just a matter of bending. It's a matter of looking good and looking self-assured and looking as if you believe it when you're bending.
I think that's for Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. I think what I would focus on for Senator Obama is less looking good, though he happens to, than on speaking to the concerns that the nation now faces in a way that is substantive and mature. And I do think that the fact that he has a really sophisticated understanding of economics, both standard and cutting edge, as well as the fact that he actually is a constitutional specialist, these are, it would be nice to have someone like that in the White House.
Where would you expect to see Barack Obama applying the wisdom of behavioral economics as a candidate in the last rounds and as president?
I think that something that Senator Obama is obviously concerned about is credit markets, that for school loans, concerning a lot of American parents and teenagers, for credit cards, concerning many of us, and for mortgages, a really, really serious problem. The old line Democratic response would be aggressive regulation in the form of mandates and bans. All economists, including behavioral economists, are a bit nervous about mandates and bans. They can squelch economic innovation. The old line types on the right tend to think that the solution to all these problems is markets, markets, and more markets. The behavioral types don't like that because they think that markets, though wonderful, sometimes exploit people's frailties, which the behavioral economists have explored in such telling detail. So what the behavioral types urge, and this is very much consistent with Senator Obama's prescriptions is, yes, freedom of choice. Absolutely. That's a part of what makes our economy work. But some gentle nudges that will make the market work better in a way that ensures that consumers aren't exploited. So I would expect Senator Obama to make transparency and disclosure real watchwords of his administration in a way that's attuned to the fact that if you give people 40 pages of fine print, that's disclosure without transparency. So I would think that he would want, both with respect to government's own behavior and with respect to handling markets that aren't treating people very well, transparency as the first-line solution. And we've actually seen this in some of his proposals. For savings, which is a bit of a problem, it puts pressure on the Social Security system when Americans aren't saving for retirement. And right now the savings rate is unbelievably low. Senator Obama does want some sort of automatic enrollment plan to be offered at firms. Now, that doesn't cost him much, if anything, to enroll people automatically. The expense for companies is tiny, but the benefits for workers, that's fabulous. And that initiative is automatic. An automatic one that's behaviorally informed. There's a more general theme. I'd suggest that the campaign, the Obama campaign, is mentioned, which is a conception of iPod government. And this is a wonderful term because the iPod is so modern, so easy, so user-friendly. It provides services in a way that is so simple for people who aren't calculators. And I would expect Obama to work hard on making government really user-friendly in a way that we've never seen before. The prescription drug plan, the Bush prescription drug plan, is kind of the opposite of iPod government. If you go on that website and try to figure it out, it's extremely confusing. Both doctors and patients are baffled. And that is just an extreme example of many frustrating encounters that we've all had at one or another time with the national government. Obama, who's so attuned, really, to making government work for people, would use state-of-the-art work on how to do that to prevent those clunky, frustrating encounters.
Cass Sunstein, last question from me. What the people want at the end of this election, I think, is to feel that we discounted against our biases of all kinds, our phony optimism about end results, our kidding ourselves about real interests. How do we get there using the kind of warning of behavioral economics that none of our brain processes, especially in the voting booth, are quite what we say they are?
That's a great question. I guess I'd say that all of us are busy, and politics, for few of us, is the number one issue. We think more about our families and our work and our friends. So I guess what I'd say is, when we decide who to vote for, and I do think we're blessed with two very strong candidates this year, it's good not to think who looks good, who makes me feel good, with whom would it be good to have a beer, whose personal life narrative is better. Both Senator McCain and Senator Obama have unbelievable, in the best sense, life stories. But that really shouldn't be what the issue turns on. They're not irrelevant, their life stories. But which narrative would make a better movie isn't really the issue. So I guess the thing that would help us counteract our biases is who going forward would make the United States better off. So who in 4 years would you be likely to say, that guy really did a good job? The country's in a better position now than it was 4 years before. I think that's the question to ask. That will orient us in the right direction. the American public is pretty sharp once it starts asking the right question.
Cass Sunstein, thank you so much for your book, Nudge, and for giving us the short course on behavioral economics. This will be a keeper.
Thank you so much. Great pleasure. Enjoyed it.